Okay, ladies and gentlemen, let me welcome all of you. This is a rare privilege, and I'm very, very delighted to welcome you here, Vice Chief Justice. It's a great pleasure. I must confess to all of you that I was a little surprised. I was asked to go down to greet the delegation when they arrived. And I was expecting to see some tottering old white-haired guy walking up, okay? And because a chief justice or a vice chief justice in America is an old guy, okay? And well, that's true. We may be setting a new standard here. But by and large, judges are old people, and of course, to see a young and vigorous, not only Vice Chief Justice, but a court, and I must say, we are delighted to have all of our other justices here as well. Thank you. This is exciting, and it's an exciting thing for us to be able to greet you and to welcome you. You are well familiar with America. You've spent so much of your time, Justice Juan, here in America, as a lecturer, as a student, as a professor, and now as a high dignitary government official. And this, I would say, we welcome you, and we hope that you will become a familiar figure in this capacity in Washington. We would like to have you. I think it's when asked about this opportunity. I jumped at the chance to do it because China, of course, is in a country going through astounding transformation. It's easiest for Westerners to see it by looking at the buildings. You know, you go to China and you see these phenomenal buildings that just pop up before you. If you're gone for more than 6 months, you know, you struggle to find the landscape that you was familiar just in your last visit. And this physical transformation is very, very obvious. Less obvious is an intellectual transformation that's also underway in the country. And I think that's what's is very much underway in the legal environment, in the judicial environment. There is a transformation that's underway. It's harder for a Westerner to see it. You know, it isn't obvious the way when you go to see the skyline in Shanghai or the skyline in Beijing or almost now any of the large countries. You know, it's immediately obvious the transition that's underway. It's, of course, much harder to see the transformation that's underway in the legal environment. And so to have you here to discuss that with us is very welcome. Very important. And I hope that you and your colleagues will think to do this more on a regular basis. We need to know more about what is underway. I will tell you candidly that in America there is a stereotype that the Chinese legal system still is arbitrary and capricious. That's still the view by many people. And undoubtedly, you can point to examples that would reinforce that view, if that's what you have already concluded. You could point to, you know, judicial developments in the United States and say a system isn't working very well, too. So I'm not, I think it's important to have a more systematic perspective on this than we will get by simply reading the occasional newspaper article in Washington that talks about some legal development in China. So we need to have a more systematic discussion. I think that you will lead us in that direction today. I doubt that we'll be satisfied entirely today because there's not enough time and not enough of you to go around, but we will get every bit of it that we can from you while you're here, Justice. Thank you. Thank you for doing it. And Professor Fireman, welcome. We're delighted that you're here. We understand that there is a personal link that ties the two of you together, which we celebrate. I think that having long-standing associations that reach back becomes the important infrastructure of progress, and it's great that you would be here to share that with us, and you will offer some observations, be the informed American that gets to lead our discussion, as opposed to me, who will only be the uninformed American that can ask questions. So let me turn to you, Justice. We welcome you. We thank you for coming. We're delighted that you gave us a chance to be on your program while you're here. Thank you for coming.
Thank you. So good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. So I feel truly honored and more than happy here to share with you some of my experience and my observations about judicial reform in China. So my presentation in the following 1.5 hours will not only be focusing on the latest development and also about potential challenges the Chinese judicial system is facing. And from a professor of law to be a justice in the Supreme Court of China, I myself have experienced almost every step of its progress. Today, however, I would rather be speaking not as a vice president of the Supreme Court, but as a professor of law or a scholar, so trying to be more objective and open-minded. So please allow me to begin with the first question: why should China to promote judicial reform? So I will just try to say something about the background for that. Internationally, we must say that China has signed or ratified several kinds of international treaties. First of all, we may say that 36 human rights conventions and treaties are signed or ratified by China, and all 33 treaties on environmental protection, and 11 treaties on intellectual property protection, and finally, 10 treaties on anti-terrorism treaties. This is the first international obligation signed by China. Secondly, the big issue is about the membership of WTO of China went into, get into, and also with the 20 agreements and attachments signed. Thirdly, a lot of bilateral agreements signed between China and other foreign countries, including the states, on extradition and the judicial cooperation in civil and criminal matters. Secondly, on the international background, is about domestic background. First background you must have known, that is that we have a continuously 30 years of economical reform, which is a success because with a high growth rate at 9.67% annually grows up. And secondly, we have very lots of new nation or new conceptions, especially the central leadership has been paying more attention to the social welfare matters, as you know, the Medicare, housing, education, food, safety, and environmental protection. So some notions you have read from newspapers, just like people's debates, continuous development, especially on the building a harmonious society. So the high growth of economy leads the public to seek further protection of their legal rights. So resulted in more disputes turning into lawsuits. So how many lawsuits? We have another expression which is called litigation explosion. I showed numbers. So the cases filed with courts since 1979. How much? How many of them? It's only 520,000 30 years ago, or almost. And 10 years later, you find that almost four times of that. Another 10 years later, three times of 10 years ago. So from the year of 2005, almost 7 million cases each year. How about last year? You will see it's going to be 9 million or 8 million. And the first 6 months of this year is going to be a senior high, more than 5 million. We are expecting maybe 10 million for the total year. That is explosion. So we really do need more judges for this heavy work. So my observation about this is a market economy requires the rule of law to govern the growing economy and to adjudicate social conflicts. So this system, the judicial system, is expected to take more responsibilities. Now, thirdly, about the legislative background. First, you may know we have not some very important constitutional law amendments. The first amendment is in 1993 about turning the planned economy into a market economy. Secondly, the rule of law is provided in 1999. And thirdly, the protection of private property. So, right now in China, there were more than 5 million private enterprises by the end of last year. And about foreign investment and foreign invested enterprises is 560,000. Another very important conception is provided in our constitution is in 2004. Talking about human rights, I have a story to tell you about my experience at Yale Law School. And I was doing my doctorate dissertation under Professor Riesman. Asked about what should I write about my doctorate dissertation. He said, try something on human rights. I said that it's too sensitive for me. We never heard something about human rights. And I tried to find something in the history of Chinese philosophy, politics, and law. Nothing. But some similar notion I found, that is, 人正. In Chinese, it is good governance. There's no human rights. The antonym of good governance is tyranny, is said by Dr. Sun Yat-sen. So probably there is some balance or some notion, or the most similar notion, it's good governance. But I don't think this is a very good expression for the whole meaning of human rights. And also I try looking to Confucius. And Confucius said in one of his great works, Zhong Yong, 仁者仁也, 亲亲为大. Anybody know ancient Chinese? Probably. If none of you, it's easier for me. So I tried to find some very official translation of this sentence. It's in this way. This fraternity or morality is the human nature. But to love your parents is the most important of all. That's teaching from Confucius. So I say there is something between that. First of all, I found something. Ren is forming from two parts. The rest part of this word means human. The left part, the right part of this one means two persons. So that's why we say when human rights, at least there should be two men or two persons. That's a collective form. That's why the Chinese government always focusing on the collective rights on the other side. Secondly, I say, they are stressing or put emphasis on the relationship between the persons, not on the, very much on the private or one single rights of one person. So, in this world, I found some difference between Western notion and Chinese tradition. That's my first understanding about human rights. Okay. So, another additional important legislation. It's another motive for judicial reform. First, you must have noticed that it's very important about administrative litigation procedure law, which marked the beginning of judicial review in China. Secondly, that is judges' law, which starts the professionalism in China as a judiciary. Third one is the supervision law. That's the first law about the relationship between the judiciary and the legislature. Next one is property law. It's going to be in effect this October. We are expecting more lawsuits when this law enters into effect. Lots of private litigation will be coming out of property rights. And finally, it's labor contract law. There will be more lawsuits about labor rights. How about the judiciary? We say there are lots of traditional Chinese to a young judiciary before reform, 30 years ago. What do I mean by young? We say before 1979, it's hardly say that there is really a professional judiciary in China, because there were no law at all sometimes. The Chief Justice in China, Xiaoyang, told me that when he was a student studying in Renmin University Law School, there were only three laws. First one is constitution, the second one is marriage law, the last one is regulation to punish the anti-revolutionaries. So, the cases in court are only two types. The first one, divorce. That's all the civil cases. The second one, all the criminals are punished as anti-revolutionaries. There's only one crime. So, can we say that there is a judiciary in that time, especially during or soon after the Cultural Revolution? No, this is very young for China to have a judiciary. So, we have lots of problems before the reform. First, there's a doubt about the fairness and impartial justice of the court system. Why? Traditionally, courts were viewed traditionally as instrument of class struggles. And punishment without any intent to protect legal rights of the accused and the innocent in criminal cases. And the local protection was so common in civil cases, especially those cases involving the parties from different jurisdictions. And when we do cases, when we have some cases really in the court arguing, and only the judges are asking questions to two parties. So always in this way, not in this way. There's no cross-examination between the parties. So witness and examination of evidence was not done in the cross way, but just by the judges asking questions. And there's no judicial review at all then. So how about due process? Never heard. There was no word like due process before 1997. Why? Because the first procedure law enacted in 1979. So before that, we have only the criminal regulation as anti-revolutionaries. And the civil procedure law came out in 1982. And last one, administrative litigation law in 1989. So before 1979, there was no procedure law at all. So how can we know anything about procedures and due process is alien conception? How about the judicial profession? Not respected. Why? Can hardly be seen any professional judges trained from law school because we have suspension of 20 years of legal education. No law school education at all. We are the first group of graduates from law school after 20 years of suspension of legal education. Just Professor Philemon told us that we are the first group benefit from the Ford Foundation. It's a very important program to introduce Chinese students to learn American law in American law schools. So we are the first group of beneficiaries in the States. And the judicial system was not running like a judiciary, just like branches of government. So the lower courts are used to report to the higher courts for final decisions, which makes the appellate hearing meaningless. Okay. And how about the judiciary? And the judges had no confidence in making the judicial system a public one. And especially judges from district court were not qualified. There was no requirement for judges, no examination for bar examination or judges by judges examination. And there's no legal analysis in judgments rendered. And the final judgments were made, but not public. Only the parties know the results. And following those shortcomings, and then judicial credibility put in doubt for two additional reasons. The first one, the final judgments were easily challenged, overruled during the retrials. By retrial, we mean here, we call it a special Chinese expression, it's supervising trial. That is a trial after final judgment. I will tell you more after that. Then, no effective enforcement mechanism for civil judgments. Because even if you have the judgment, it's final, and the party who has lost the case but not automatically honored the judgments, and the court would be trying their best to find where they are and their assets. So sometimes the judgments are not honored. So from the foregoing expression or experience, I have reached some preliminary summary or some understandings. First of all, I should say the judicial reform is a natural outcome of political reform following 30 years of successful economic reforms in China. That is very much connected. Second of all, as judicial reform is an inevitable and unstoppable trend in China, since the general people, the central leading group, as well as the whole judiciary demanded. Thirdly, there is a sentence expressed in this way: democracy, rule of law, freedom, human rights, equality, and fraternity are values shared universally. Make a guess who is speaking. Probably one of the Western leaders, it sounds like. But it's from this man, the Premier of China. He's talking to foreign journalists. So the human rights and democracy, this new conception, is not a new one, accepted by top leaders and the grassroots people. However, different nations might have different approaches to realize and cherish these values, but I think they are most closely related to judicial functions. So, Chinese judiciary should not be the exception. If we want to really have this or the best results from this judicial reform, we have to do something by ourselves. Besides, we can draw some experience from other jurisdictions. So we have to depend on the effective strategy, as well have a suitable pace, which are adjusted to the real practice in the Chinese society. For instance, we learn something very important from common law system, like jury system, dissenting opinions, and legal aid, leading case methods. I will mention that in my following presentation. So this, the following is my main part of introduction, the process and achievements of judicial reform in China. I will just tell you the stories in two sessions. The first one is about first five-year plan for judicial reform, which covers the year from 1999 to 2003. The goals and demands set for this 5 years plan will have several. First one is we need to have a full establishment of all procedures, I mean civil, criminal, and administrative litigation procedures. Second, we need independence of judges and collegiate bench in trials. What is collegiate bench? Which is the bench consists of three judges with one sitting in central as the presiding judge. And they may reach opinion of a majority vote of two against the dissenting one, most of the cases in this way. But sometimes three judges have three different opinions. And how should we do? We have another commission above that. And thirdly, rebuilding judicial credibility. Fourthly, we have to reconstruct a professional judiciary. Finally, we need better facilities for court. That's the general goals and purpose. So how did we do for the first 5 years? Some concrete measures. First of all, we have full judicial interpretation by the Supreme Court about these procedures, three procedures. Judicial interpretation is a special feature of Chinese judicial system. Without that, lawyers cannot do anything about litigation. Because, you know, in a civil law country, most of laws are abstract. So we need to interpret some of their terms and provisions so that the judges and lawyers can apply these laws in a very concrete merit. Those interpretations would be followed by all the lower courts in China. Only the Supreme Court can issue interpretations. Okay? Just like a lawmaking process. But it's not. So, something is said about the gaps between the lawmaking process that's from National People's Congress and the power, as we discussed, from the Supreme Court of China. Probably I'll come back for this notion later. Secondly, we introduce single-judge trial procedures because we have litigation explosion. We need more judges. If every case is tried by three judges, then there will be a problem for us because we have a statute of limitations for 3 months for the first trial and or 6 months for the first trial, 3 months for the second appellate sessions. I don't think there is any other system which have statute of limitations for the efficiency of the judiciary. It's required in Chinese law by procedure law. Certainly, sentencing power was given to the collegiate bench and decided by the majority vote, as I told. And cross-examination, first of all, is introduced to court hearing and argument. Okay, never before, only the judge is speaking and asking. Right now, let the parties have cross-file between themselves. That easier to find evidence and witness testify. Then established enforcement offices in all levels of court. Okay. And full law school education required for new judges. For those judges, for experienced judges who cannot ask them to go over again for the exams, then new judges, they must pass national exam. Courthouse restructuring is very much covered in different places in China. For instance, I show a picture. This is one of the local courthouse in China. Very beautiful. And sometimes in some major cities, courthouse has been a landmark just beside bank's building. You're welcome to my court, which is the Supreme Court of China. It's really beautiful and huge house. Now, very brief for the first 5 years, I'll put my emphasis on the second 5-year plan, which covers the year from 2004 until next year. The goals and demands would be different with the first 5-year plan. First of all, we have to ensure the judicial fairness and neutrality of the court. Second one, try to improve the credibility with more method to enforce the civil judgments and redefine the retrial conditions for civil litigations. I come back for this. Third one, to ensure the consistent application of law after joining WTO, because it's one of the principles of WTO. We have, you know, more than 3,000 trial courts in China and 300 intermediate courts in China and other 31 or 2 high courts in China, 4 levels of court. So how can they reach agreements or have the same judgments on same facts? That's really a great challenge for China. Fourthly, to encourage more judicial transparency. Again, is required by WTO principle. And fifthly, to promote judicial professionalism by attracting the best legal professionals to court. Finally, to increase judicial efficiency. Really, we need more to deal with the litigation explosion. So how did we do and have been doing? Some concrete measures. First of all, we try something for judicial neutrality. There is 4 levels of courts in China. There are also 4 levels of Congress in China. All the judges appointed by the local Congress in trial court, appellate court, and high court. And the justice from the Supreme Court appointed by the National People's Congress. So there is sometimes conflicts between the Congress, especially local Congress, and the local courts. A lot of stories about that. One of them is that the local Congress is trying to look into the individual cases tried by local courts because they think the Constitution entrusted them with this power as supervising over the judiciary. So China is not a country with checks and balances. The Congress is in higher position than the government and the judiciary. We call the Congress has the power as the mother power, not only legislation. Legislating, making law, lawmaking is one of its power. The most important power for the Congress is to elect the president of court, the governors, or other chief officials of the local governments. So they think they have the power looking into individual cases. But after, even in some local cities or provinces, maybe sometimes dozens of cases or more than 50 cases were looked into by the congressman. And they have already promulgated some of the local regulations for that. After several years of practice, they found themselves in trouble because the local people just look into the congressman as the appellate court for the local courts. They said, yeah, you have supervising power, then the courts, then we present the case to you. But they have only one chance to hear from one of the parties, not two. Sometimes they make decisions even. And their decisions sometimes, most of the time, were overruled by the higher court. You know, yeah, local Congress can look into the case in the same level of the court, but their decision would be followed by the court, and one of the other party, I mean the party who are not helped by the local Congress, appeal to the high court, and the high court overruled. So they're coming a very important law, that's the supervision law. No more congressional interference of individual case in local courts from 2006. This is the first law to balance the powers between the judiciary and the legislation. And they have the power only listening to the reports of the courts every year. That is the president. One of our presidents here has to report to the provincial congress. And also sometimes they may inspect or inquire or do some investigation on court regulations, especially on the Supreme Court. When we are issuing some interpretation of laws, we need to report to the National People's Congress whether they are informed, consistent with the Constitution or the other laws, or some special issues. Secondly, we're trying to balance the prosecutors and the defendants in criminal procedure. That's important because prosecutors are part of the judiciary, just like most of the civil countries in Europe. So the lawyers think they have more privileges. So how do we balance them? Cross-examination. So both ends are equal. Evidence, witness, examined on court, in court. Then come to human rights protection. For human rights protection, probably we do not really have only very single, very limited notion just on the accused. But we also have something different. Of course, first of all, we have the very important principle recognized, that's a presumption of innocence, recognized and applied in court hearings. And procedural rights to guarantee the fair trials enforced by procedural laws, its interpretation of law by the Supreme Court. Thirdly, we have to rule out all the confessions without corroborating evidence. So try to eliminate possible cruel treatment of the defendant during the investigation. Probably we can eliminate all of them, at least when those evidence, only confession present in the court before the judge, without other corroborating evidence completely ruled out by the judges. Okay. Sometimes we meet some problems with some disputes in more detail. I couldn't tell right here because of time. Approximately 6,000 to 4,000 persons were declared innocent between or during the year of 2000 and 2004. The numbers are going down. In 2005, a little bit more than 2,000. And last year, fewer than 2,000. The prosecutors said they have already increased their quality for litigation, public litigation. Possibly true, but sometimes the judges have different story. The reason I said we have a larger conception of human rights protection in criminal procedure or in the litigation is because we have something to do, not only for accused, but also for disadvantaged plaintiffs. That is conception of legal aid. As we discussed with Professor Feynman, The first institution for legal aid was founded in 1992. Happily, I was the founder for this institution. It's in Wuhan University Law School. We call it Center for Protection of Rights of Disadvantaged Citizens. 15 years now, they continue their job, offering free legal aid services to senior persons, children, women, handicapped, as well as the plaintiffs in administrative litigation. Criminal suspects were provided with free legal aid services, not only by NGO institutions, but all the city level offices, as Ministry of Justice, established their agencies to provide free legal aid. We also expand the notion of legal aid into a judicial aid. You know, the legal aid conception was accepted by the former Minister of Justice, who is now the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, Xiaoyang. So he brought this notion from legal aid to judicial aid. What does judicial aid mean? Which means we just waived and deduct the litigation fees for the poor litigants, I mean the plaintiffs in civil litigation or criminal litigation. Annually, especially for last year, 1.2 billion yuan waived. And this is something special in China, that the plaintiff, when you are filing a case with court, you have to handle some money for registration. Another development about protection of human rights, we are not only focusing on the accused and the plaintiffs, but also for the victims in criminal cases. By victims of criminal cases, we mean if somebody was killed in a criminal case during the investigation, and his relatives were left over with nothing, with nobody to take care of them. So some of the local courts are trying to establish a foundation to pay for damages if the accused has no ability to pay for that. Like Beijing court and the court in Shandong and other provinces, some rich provinces provide many damages for those victims. So this is not a notion of human rights protection. The plaintiffs, the accused, as well as the victims of criminal procedure. Okay? They are also human. Their rights are in harm. Then we have to provide full protection of those. Then let's come to the judicial review of executive decisions. The first problem we were meeting during the first 1 or 2 years of judicial review is something we say, the local protectionism. Okay? Just because the defendants are mostly local government officials, or their branches, so it's very difficult for the judiciary to do something in the first 1 or 2 years. What did we do? We have a new notion as cross-jurisdiction. That means if a case is filed as the local government, as the defendant, and this case would be handed over to the neighbor court, I mean the court in other county or in other province, and the case is cross. We call it cross-jurisdiction. And if the local government, even the city level, the mayor, was the responsible defendant for the case, then probably the case would be in a higher court, not really under the jurisdiction of the executive. And not only we have so many courts, but also all the courts has the jurisdiction very much the same, overlapped with the executive boundary. Just like if you state jurisdiction properly, but we really need something from a federal jurisdiction, especially cases involving the interests of different of the parties from different jurisdiction or different states. Okay. And then the chief officials right now, especially after 5 years of practice of judicial review, all the officials are required to appear in the court as defendant's representatives, with the notion that try to learn something from what you have been doing wrong. And more emphasis on enforcement of judicial review judgments. I show some numbers. So this is the number for the last year. 17,000 administrative decisions declared invalid, illegal. Probably not all the decisions are wrong. Partly wrong would be right. And then we have 30%, 34% of total of this number of decisions change their decisions. I mean the changes of 34% of total 92,000 decisions made by the governments or their branches. We have a calculation of all the cases by the court in different levels. Only 18% of the total executive decisions in disputes were sustained by the court. So, judiciary is really functioning as a checks and balance over the government. Now let's come to the special civil jurisdiction, trying to avoid local protection in criminal cases. Same thing as cross-jurisdiction and higher court jurisdiction, as well as third-place jurisdiction. Okay, almost the same with the administrative litigation. Now, consistency of application of law. You must have noticed how should we do with the death penalty cases. From first day of this year, and all death penalty cases must be reviewed by the Supreme Court. So we have laid some general principles and more prudent judgments and fewer capital punishments. Secondly, trying every effort to avoid wrong decisions. There were some before we have this decision. Death penalty only for the most serious crimes is provided by the Human Rights Convention. Another notion very special in China, not all the death penalty cases and those criminals are executed. We have a very special term, it's a 2 year suspension, which means if you are sentenced for death penalty, then you will be kept in the prison to see how you are behaving during these 2 years. If you are behaving yourself quite good, and not doing anything against law, then the death penalty will be turned into life sentence, or 20 years in prison. I never heard one single case with the death penalty and 2 years suspension turning into the case for immediate execution. So sometimes there will be misleading for all the death penalty cases in numbers in China. Second, very important is about death penalty cases must be subject to appellate hearing before being submitted to the Supreme Court for final review. Before that, some of the cases, or at least half of the cases, were not heard in the appellate session. Just do paperwork, they say. Then about international cases. Cases involving international trade and investment, The initial hearing is not in the basic court, I mean the trial court, but in intermediate courts. We call it central jurisdiction. For instance, only one court was designated to take these cases in one province, probably the capital city court. Second, judicial review on international arbitration awards. And the preliminary decisions on non-recognition or refusal to enforce and international arbitration awards must be submitted to provincial high courts and the Supreme Court for final decision. What does it mean? If a case filed with intermediate court for refusal or refuse to recognize international arbitration awards, this court has no right to do or to render its final decision. It must report to the higher court. If the higher court, I mean the provincial high court, agree with lower court, I mean the intermediate court, first in a preliminary decision, the high court cannot do the final decision. They must report to me because I'm in charge of all these type of cases. If I, especially my division, will agree with the lower court, I mean the high court, then that's final. Vice versa, if the intermediate court make the decision that they are not going to recognize or refuse to recognize this international arbitration award, and the high court, no, is correct with New York Convention, we cannot refuse to recognize, then that's over. So we take very cautious examination or judicial review of international arbitration awards. Otherwise, then different courts may have different standards. So New York Convention is very much strictly followed. And also another very important notion about maritime courts jurisdiction. Maritime court, we have 10 along coastlines of China. They have a very good notion as a judicial district. As I said, most of the courts in China overlapped in jurisdiction with the executive boundary. That is the resources for local protectionism. But maritime court is different. For instance, Wuhan Maritime Court, which sits on one of the banks in Yangtze River in Wuhan City, Hubei Province. It enjoys jurisdiction from upstream Chongqing to downstream Shanghai. 6 provinces, 9 cities. So nobody, no mayor or governor of the provinces can influence the decision of the maritime court. We call this is not an executive boundary district, but judicial district. So the judges appointed by the provincial high courts, and those judges were qualified. Most of them are graduate students after their first degree in law school. And adequate financial budget ensured for their judicial functions. And finally, we call this as a long-arm jurisdiction without local protectionism. This has been defined as the future of our judicial reform in China, trying to take something as your federal jurisdiction or something like a Russian commercial courts from the Supreme Court, the Appellate Court, and the Trial Courts. Another new development about the leading case method. When we say leading case method, something very similar with your stare decisis. That's not the same. We say this is not a norm-making process just for reference decisions. And we have the principle, it's similar facts with consistent judgments. Okay? More than 3,000 courts. They may have similar facts, but we need consistent judgments. Also, sometimes leading case from lower court may be declared by the Supreme Court as the model for other courts, for all other courts. Not really the Supreme Court making the final decision as a leading case. Those cases may be conflicting, but one of the case would be declared as a leading case. Our professional judiciary, well, what we were doing, selecting and promotion mechanism for judges. Now from 2001-2002, we have a unified exams for all legal professions like judges, prosecutors, and lawyers. And more experienced lawyers and famous professors joined the judiciary. For instance, in Springwood, we have 7 full law professors become justice or senior judges. And the last year, you know, we have more than 100 judges from lower court promoted to the higher court as judges, and even in the Supreme Court. How we select these judges? Sometimes we have national competition for best judgments. If they can write good judgments, probably they're one of the sources for us to define the new and the better judges. So, professional administration. Now something about reform of adjudication commission, which I mentioned about collegiate bench. When the 3 judges cannot reach a majority vote or decision, then the 3 different opinions will be presented to this commission for final decision. That's why Chinese court is a collective decision maker, not really by single judge. So we split them into 2 groups. The first group is subcommittee of civil and administrative litigation. The other is a subcommittee for criminal litigation. So more professionals in different groups also speed up our process as judicial efficiency. So some training programs in national judges. I try to say very briefly about this. I want to leave more time for your questions. Okay. So training judges in 10 years and in different branches of National Judges College. We now have very good programs with Temple University Law School, and we have selected several judges to be trained in Temple University Law School with master's degree, and 38 judges graduated. And next year we're going to have a program with Hong Kong City University Law School. Every year we have 20 judges trained in this law school. And also exchanges with foreign judiciary circles and international organizations. We have a very good conference last year called 22nd World Law Congress in Beijing. Okay. More pictures about this one. And Justice Kennedy also participated and also presided over some of the sessions. And we have lots of joint programs with some international organizations, and we create the forums for world famous jurists in National Judges College. This is the president of Russian Supreme Court, and justice also from Canadian Chief Justice, and also Chief Justice from Australian Supreme Court. And Justice Scalia speaking in our National Judges College. We have some other special programs, especially I want to mention the Asian Consultation and Due Process programs. We send 10 judges from China in Bangkok every year, and also the organizer invites some judges and professors, as well as lawyers from India, Sri Lanka, Singapore, Hong Kong, from common law countries and districts. So the 10 judges prepare the 2 cases, one criminal, the other administrative litigation case, and they retry the same case as happened, the real case. And 3 judges play their own role. The rest of judges play witness and the parties as well as the lawyers. So after this demonstration of trial, and the facts handed over to other groups of judges and lawyers. They are from common law countries and districts. And in most of the cases, the decision reached or rendered by different groups of judges totally different. Do you see what I mean? If we tried in Chinese procedure, this criminal was guilty. But tried by common law system procedure, not guilty. So everybody is surprised. Why? Then sit down to discuss what is really wrong. We call this is comparative, very much encouraging, and with common law countries and districts. So we also send judges to study and also to practice due research in seminars in the international conference. So I'll mention very quickly about exchange between the two Supreme Courts in China and in the USA. That's Justice Kennedy with our Chief Justice Xiao Yang, and Justice Ginsburg with Chief Justice Xiao Yang, and also Justice O'Connell, the lecturer in our National Judges College, and also Chief Justice leading the delegation from China visiting the Federal Supreme Court, and meeting with several very important persons and judges and justices, Scalia. Also, our Vice President, a very distinguished professor, Cao Jianmin, I'm meeting with Justice Scalia. And I have a very good chance to meet with Justice Ginsburg in her home for dinner. So, trying to go over something, I don't think I need to say today because of time about judicial transparency and democracy. Some very important that I have to mention is that the Supreme Court issued rules for public trial. First of all, we said all the court session should be open to person with ID, okay, over 18 years of old. And there were only three exceptions: cases on state secrets, juvenile issues, and privacy. Very important, we say that important cases may be televised, just like the O.J. Simpson case I experienced 10 years ago in Los Angeles. And especially very active websites. Most of the cases, important cases, especially local influential cases, are broadcasted live on internet. Okay. And also another very important development about people's ancestors. We learn something from a jury system, but it's not the same. It's not a copy of the jury. The first instance is that the people's ancestors, they are functionally as the real judge with all the full power to make decision on fact findings, applying law, and sentencing. Not only on facts. And right now, they are doing more cases on marriage, especially on family matters, IP cases, and maritime issues, as well as serious criminal cases. Especially on IP and maritime issues, we select those assessors from captain or sailor in maritime courts, scientists in IP sessions. So they have a lot, because judges are not really good enough for science or especially for some different type of cases. This is one of the pictures for we call the layman judge not in judicial role. That's the numbers for the cases and the people's assesses they have done in last year, and covered more than 30% of all the cases since 2005. But they need professional training. Really, now the National Judges College is trying to provide some professional training for the process, for the assessors.
I want to hear from Justice Fireman real quick.
Okay. So publication of judges. So we have cases published, and we have a monthly magazine called Gazette of Supreme Court. And happy news, we have an English edition of case that is called the China Law Report. You can find in one of the law schools, probably most of the famous law schools in the States, and your Congress library. We have different websites with judgments. That is the Supreme Court, ChinaLawCourt.org, and all local courts with provincial high courts has their own websites. Okay, and two special. One is intellectual property rights website. We call it ChinaIPLaw.cn. And also for maritime and international cases, we have CCMT, China Commercial Maritime Trial. Then dissenting opinions. Probably never there is any dissenting opinions disclosed in our judgments before. Because, as I said, all the judgments are rendered by court, not by judge. So, in 2002, the first judgment with dissenting opinion disclosed in judgments, and lots of debates. And it said it's against the law, it's against the rule for them to disclose. But most of the judges say that's good. This is a good thing. That's a democracy in judiciary. And also, that's the trend for international judiciary, especially in ICJ, in the International Court of Justice, and also European Court of Human Rights. And some of the civil law countries are doing the same thing. So I encourage them, yes, you can continue going with this trend, and then followed by other courts from Beijing and Shanghai. Now, judicial credibility.
I think we need to wrap up in about 3 more minutes.
Okay. Sure. Very quickly about the last one. And the retrial procedure, that's important for procedures. And this procedure will be amended next month in October. So limited reasons for retrial. Then I just go quickly. And then another procedure is about enforcement. I mean the civil judgments enforcement. So, enforcement measures would be including the following very important one. There's 2-year statute of limitation for application. Right now, there's only 6 months. Why should I mention that? Most, some of the foreign investors, if they win the case, especially in international arbitration awards, they find them, they have already expired their time for application of the enforcement. So 6 months is too short for them. So we extend to 2 years. Now more enforcement actions will be taken. That is more and longer judicial detention and more fines. And imperative report on assets of last year. And the blacklist in the credit system and suspension of its immigration rights. Okay. Probably just very quickly about the future, some 12 issues. I just mentioned one or two of them, especially about the first one on due process. How to balance the judicial efficiency and quality. The second one, we are doing a lot about mediation. Do judicial mediation needs due process? And thirdly, whether we should do something criminal as plea bargaining. That is very heated discussion right now in China. And the fourth one, local judges appointment system. You know, 4 levels of Congress, 4 levels of courts. Whether those judges could be appointed by just 1 level or just 2 level, provincial and national. And the commercial cases, can we develop it from maritime into over the maritime case to a commercial case? And the judicial financial support, can we from the government to the natural nature? Credibility, quickly, quotes, should we do something and just retreat from civil enforcement? Because that's not good for judges to do enforcement. How to protect the rights of the victims of the criminal judgments? And how to balance the judicial discretion, especially the Supreme Court, about the judicial interpretation, and also the relationship with the medium. Finally, we said lack of enough qualified judges in remote and western districts, and they need some local standard. And the professional management of judiciary. Okay. Finally, I read some story from the front page of USA Today. That is, some professional, very experienced judges retired or resigned from their posts because of gap of the salary between federal judges and the deans of law schools. Same thing in China, we're facing the program. Okay? So some few words in roundup. So China is a comparatively late starter in judicial reform. And Chinese judiciary system has been both, has seen both brilliant prospects and rough road leading to the goal. And I believe both as a participant and also as a witness of this process, the reform is progressing steadily in the right direction. Okay? And we also fully understand that any reform is a painstaking process, but Chinese judiciary is determined to have more perspective and more breakthroughs in the next 5 years to come. Okay, that's conclude my presentation. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, Justice Swan. This was very, very fulsome. Professor Feinerman, if we could turn to you. We've asked you to be a formal respondent. We think that you will give more structure to our questions, and we'll begin with you, please.
Well, I'll try to be brief because I know that we're supposed to wrap up at 4:30 today. I'd just like to say, since Justice Wan introduced Confucius in his remarks, the beginning of Confucius's Analects, the Lun Yu, has a famous phrase that to have a friend come from afar is indeed a pleasure, and it's a pleasure for me to be here on the same program with Justice Wan, whom I've known directly and indirectly for many years since he was first chosen by the CLEAC program to be one of the first recipients of the Ford Foundation's grants to come to the United States and study. He really ran with the ball. He, first of all, did an LLM at Yale Law School, and went on to do a judicial doctorate, the SJD, at the University of Michigan. So he's been at two of the most distinguished law schools in the United States. Even more importantly, as he referenced briefly in his talk, he brought the idea of legal aid and the legal aid programs that we have in American law schools to China, starting with his own law school at Wuhan. And I think that one of the major reforms, in fact, we could have a whole program just about this, in China over the last 15 years has been the extension of legal representation to underserved populations so they can actually make use of these courts that have now been reformed and come into more widespread usage by the Chinese people. So that all by itself was a fantastic contribution to the Chinese justice system. He's continued, of course, to make more contributions as a vice president of the Supreme People's Court, and I hope that he'll be able to do this for many more years. I would just note also in introduction, and I'll try and say my comments in about 4 or 5 minutes to leave time for your questions and comments, that it's extraordinary, and even this full presentation may not have really reflected the full context of this, what has happened in China in just a few decades. I started studying Chinese law as a law student in the mid-1970s at Harvard Law School under what was then the one and only program teaching Chinese law with Jerry Cohn at Harvard Law School. And he began our class in Chinese law by saying, the first thing you need to know about Chinese law is there isn't any. And then after letting that sink in, he would say, well, that's not exactly true, and we'll spend the next 14 weeks finding out what there was. But this was 1976. it was the tail end of the Cultural Revolution. Mao had not yet died. Zhou Enlai had died at the beginning of the semester. And we didn't have any idea about what was going to develop subsequently. And as Justice Wan said, there were essentially four or five legal documents that were all the laws of China at the time. There was a new constitution that the Gang of Four had put forward in 1975. There was that famous counter-revolutionary code. There was also a law against corruption. But there wasn't really much to go on. And Professor Cohn and the other pioneers of Chinese legal studies in the United States basically interviewed refugees in Hong Kong to find out what had happened in China with respect to law for the 25 years since the founding of the People's Republic of China. When I went to Peking University in the first group of exchange students in 1979, when I graduated from law school, I was one of five students who had been trained as lawyers in the United States, and we were told that at Beida we could not study law. It was not one of the departments that was open to foreign students. And when we tried to push a little further, we were told that law was an extremely secret discipline, jue mi. And as I learned later, the only thing that was jue mi about the law department was that there really wasn't any law department. The law department was just reopened in 1978, and they were a little embarrassed about the level of instruction there. But last year, in 2006, I went back as a Fulbrighter to Tsinghua University, where I lectured in the program that Justice Wan mentioned about judicial training that is run by Temple Law School, and saw the incredible progress that was made, the fact that there was a devoted training facility trying to bring the judges in the Supreme People's Court along, and that these were replicated in courts at other levels and in localities in China, I think is a tremendous testimony to the seriousness with which China has embraced this this program. I would just mention a couple of things that draw on some of the points that Justice Wan made as sort of a laundry list of things that may also spark some of your questions. One is about the quality of lawyers and judges. This is obviously a key question, and it's something that is still a work in progress as far as China is concerned. When the courts were reestablished in the early 1980s, one of the interesting facts was that there were no trained judges, as you were told. Their legal education had been closed down for 20 years. So the first judges, and they sort of waved a magic wand to make them judges, were retired military and police officers who at least had some experience with a form of the justice system. But you can imagine what the courts of the United States or any other country would be like if the judiciary was all drawn from that segment of the population. And these were people, too, who were not necessarily well-educated in general. They weren't university graduates in any department. And so it's taken a generation to produce the kind of people, and few of them reach the high quality of Justice Wan, who have the skills to really be professional judges and lawyers. The lawyers as well were sort of taken from the streets, people who had qualifications in other fields, engineers, specialists, anyone with a university degree who could sort of think and write and make plausible legal arguments could qualify as a lawyer. Now there's a new generation of lawyers, and there's been a transformation of the lawyer's law parallel to that of the judge's law, which means the lawyers are really fully trained professionals now, and there'll be a second generation of them coming along soon. The local protectionism thing, I think, is going to be a very difficult issue to solve, moving on to another topic. And one of the things that I would just point out here, in addition to the points that Justice Wan has already made, is that I think the question of who pays the judges' salaries may be the most important thing here. It's still the case that the judicial salary is paid by the local government at every level where the judge serves. So the local people's court is paid by the local people's government. The provincial people's court is paid by the provincial government. And that's very different than the United States system, where federal judges down to the district court level are paid from the federal budget. It's maybe more like what happens in state courts in the United States, where, among other things, and you may not want to copy this practice, our state court judges are often elected in the majority of states, even at the Supreme Court level. So I think that that's going to be a key thing to solving the local protectionism question. When they don't feel that the judgments they make jeopardize the possibility of having their own salaries get paid, they'll be freer to make truly independent and fair judgments. I would just mention three more things, and then I'll open the floor up for your questions. One is that Justice Wan has given us a pretty full picture of things that have happened in the last few years, but with respect to that second five-year plan, there was a very complex 50-point document divided into, I think, seven major headings of things that the court reform process was supposed to do in a five-year period. And I don't think that there's any judiciary, certainly not here in the United States over the last 220 years, that's attempted such a broad range of things in such a short period of time. It really is extraordinarily ambitious, even if they can't complete every element of it, and I'm sure that the next five-year plan will carry over some of the things that were started in this second five-year plan, actually started even in the first five-year plan. It's going to be important to monitor how those things proceed and actually get implemented. I just want to mention, in closing, the death penalty, the WTO, and corruption. Necessarily in that order, because that's the way I listed them. With regard to the death penalty, I think the signal reform of the last decade has been taking back the power at the Supreme People's Court level to finally decide death penalty cases. No other thing has the possibility of making such a transformation, at least in the criminal justice system of China. And the Supreme People's Court had that power in the original criminal law that was passed in 1980, but as a practical matter, it just didn't have the personnel and couldn't process all the death penalty cases that come up. China executes in the average year, depending on the statistics in the year, anywhere from 2,000 to 4,000 people. There are more cases that are actually adjudicated, as Justice Wan has mentioned, the death penalty, but it's suspended in its imposition. It was even done for two of the Gang of Four who were sentenced to death in their trial in 1980, but the imposition was suspended, and as he predicted, they did not subsequently get executed. That is, their death penalty was commuted to a life sentence. So even for the worst offenders in recent Chinese history, there's leniency. With regard to the WTO, I would just question whether China's had a relative peaceful period in the first 5 years after accession, but I think that there may be a rockier road in the future. I think most countries, including the United States, were willing to give China not necessarily a free pass, but time to accustom itself to the rigors of the WTO jurisprudence. But as the United States has started bringing more cases, the European Union is also lined up to do this. Japan has indicated some willingness to join the U.S. or the EU as plaintiffs in those cases. I think there's going to be more work, and here China has set up some special courts in Beijing and Shanghai to deal specifically with WTO-related cases. And lastly, although I don't mean to close on a sour note, there is a problem, and both Western and Chinese litigants have talked about this, of judicial corruption in China, and it's related to the problem of salaries that Justice Wan mentioned, including at the closing of his speech. I grew up and was raised in Chicago, so I'm no stranger myself to the problem of judicial corruption in this country. It's a worldwide problem. It's a global problem, and it will happen any place where judicial salaries are significantly below what lawyers and other professionals with the same kind of training can command. And it's also something that has to be systematically addressed using every weapon at your disposal, including the criminal justice system. But I think that the confidence that Justice Wan seeks for the judiciary as a whole and for the profession in Chinese society is going to be greatly enhanced as the public perception that judges are corrupt or corruptible is gradually eased. So I've probably gone on too long, but let me stop there.
We have just a few minutes, but we open up the floor if there are other questions or comments that colleagues want to raise or make.
Yes, you know, as for legal aid programs, they have agencies in every city, so everybody knows that from newspaper. They have telephones advertised. And also for the court session opening, so everybody with ID, any case you show the ID to the guard, and then you can go to the session, except only three type of cases. So
I would also just add that law students actually do something called shishi gongzuo as part of their law school education. And they actually sit on the streets and answer questions from the public and will refer people to the legal aid offices when they can't provide a quick answer to their legal questions.
Yeah, you know, our cases are oftentimes shown on CCTV, so some typical cases of that, and lots of call will be coming to next day.
Thank you.
So no advertisements in that.
Just while we're waiting for other questions, would you be willing to share your slides with us, Justice Wan? I thought they were very interesting and very helpful. Would it be possible to get the electrons so that we could, and if anybody would like to have a copy of them, please let us know. We'd be happy to provide them to you. Sir?
A question about the assessors.
Okay. Probably I'll just leave some
That would be perfect.
Justice Wan, I had a question about the assessors. You described them as these are laymen who are sort of drafted in, not quite comparable to American jurors, but similar, I guess. But one of the striking things you mentioned is that they have the authority to make law. There was no judge there to instruct them on what the law is. They, in addition to finding facts, they also have some authority to make law. Did I understand that correctly, or what is there? Could you describe a little bit more about this? And is it possible you would go into court and find the taxi cab driver as your judge, and he would be making the decisions or something?
No, thank you. Very good question. You know, as the people's assessor, he shared the same power as an ordinary judge, but all the judges in China are not making law. The lawmaking power, it belongs to the legislature in all the Congress. But only the provisional level and national level can make laws. So the people's assess just function as ordinary judge with the same power, fixed findings, and also the law application. I mean, just apply the law to the facts. And as about who could be the assessors, not that any taxi driver off on the street, but they are elected by the local Congress. Most of them, I say, they are professors from law school. Easier for them to be chosen as assessors, or scientists, or captain or sailors who have some capacity in some certain areas. They are specialists sometimes. Also, some neighborhood specialists for family matters, for women's feminist organization or something, they could be chosen as one of the assessors for women cases.
Okay. Professor Feinerman, is this close to a court master then in the American system?
Not exactly. I mean, I know in the past when there was a collegiate bench and not just a single judge, the lay assessors usually served with a judge. That is, they never acted alone to decide a case, but they served two lay assessors with a judge as a three-judge panel. So, and we've had this in the United States. In Vermont, they actually had this until it was ruled unconstitutional up until about 20 years ago. And in many civil law countries, they do this too. In German commercial courts, for example, it's a single commercial court judge with two commercial experts in the field, just as Justice Wan was suggesting, somebody who knows maritime matters or banking.
Experts.
Yes.
Experts.
So there's sort of a qualified juror.
Yeah, great one.
We could use more qualified jurors in America. We've reached our hour. This was fascinating, Justice Wan. I think those of us that get to China but only see the very superficial things about China were given a deep look on something very, very important. And you helped me enormously today. I hope I speak for my colleagues. Professor Feinerman, you added a great deal of depth to this, because many questions I wasn't wise enough even to formulate, you put before us, and you brought out a deeper and richer texture for this discussion. So on behalf of my colleagues, thank you. We're delighted that both of you could be here. You are a young man, and I think that's excellent, because that means you get to do a long bit of service helping build this judicial system for China. Thank you very much for being with us, Justice.
My pleasure.
Thank you, colleagues. Thank you.